Hello, and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. My name's John Connolly, and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Speaking today to the European Parliament, Donald Tusk said that at one summit, one Prime Minister warned us not to be dreamers, not to think Brexit could be reversed. But in this difficult moment, we need dreamers and dreams. We cannot give in to fatalism. At least I will not stop dreaming about a united Europe. James, how well do you think his comments are going to go down in the UK?
Well, this kind of sub-John Lennon-style rhetoric from Donald Tusk, I think, illustrates one of the problems that has bedeviled the Brexit talks, which is, as long as people think that Brexit is not settled, but there is a chance that the UK could change its mind and decide to stay in the EU, then you're not going to get a sensible deal, because rather your aim is to say, oh, look, all of these other things, you know, don't do this, come back in. And I think that is problematic. I think one of the things that has caused so many problems in this first round of the Brexit talks is the level of emotion involved on all sides, frankly, which has made things more difficult. People often say, oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. The second phase of the Brexit talks is going to be far more difficult. And look, there is an argument that in the trade negotiation will be brutal and difficult. But I think in one crucial respect, it will be easier, because at the moment that trade negotiation starts, the UK will have left the EU. Brexit will be a legal reality. And for that reason, I think it will not be as emotionally fraught a negotiation as this first round has been.
And how about you, Katie? Do you think there's a Brexit delay or being stopped altogether is likely now?
I think the problem for Donald Tusk and his dream is that the length of the Article 50 extension is not actually what most people's vote campaigners would have wanted. They were after as long extension as possible, because the longer the extension, the more time you have, A, to get people to come around to the idea of a second referendum. And those pushing for a second referendum really believed that having indicative votes was never going to be the way you necessarily got to one. The way you get people to change their mind is to just make sure they exhaust all the other options and then say, well, given that we can't agree on anything, maybe now it is time to put it back to a public vote. So you need time for that to happen if it is going to work. And two, you need time to somehow agree a question and start to get that into motion, particularly when you have a government that's vehemently opposed to having a second referendum. So I think 6 months is cutting up really fine for that, and it's hard to see how it could really fit into that. Of course, you could get the wheels in motion, but I do think it is harder. And definitely when the EU leaders and the European Commission were all discussing what length of extension they should give to Theresa May when she asked for that second Brexit delay, there were certain voices, and I think that includes Tusk's, who were after that longer extension. And I think his comments give us a bit of a hint as to why that was.
And do you think his comments could actually be helpful to the PM in that it sort of puts the fear into Brexiteers that Brexit could be cancelled?
Well, look, we throughout this process, we've been saying, the proof that Brexit is going to end up being softer or not happening at all unless Theresa May's deal passes will force the recalcitrant Brexiteers to fold to back the deal. Now, that approach has worked on some people. You know, in the end, when the withdrawal agreement on its own was brought back for that third time, you did have Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, Ian Duncan-Smith, Jacob Rees-Mogg vote for it. But on the other hand, there are some people who look like, I mean, who are taking pride in their refusal to vote for it. You know, the Steve Baker and the Marc Francois, the people who want to see themselves in a gross historical slur on the Spartans as the Spartans. Almost their view is almost this, which is they almost don't care if Brexit is cancelled, because they kind of want to say, it's going to be on you if you do it. You know, you people who do that, you know, I will just carry on voting down the deal because I don't like the deal, and whatever else follows is not my responsibility. And I think that for that reason, it's very hard to see them coming round. I mean, it is worth remembering that Steve Baker did consider backing the deal. You know, he himself has said that he got halfway through writing a newspaper article the night before explaining why it was now time to vote for the withdrawal agreement. But I think he's kind of almost kind of reacted against that, his own moment of equivocation there. You know, I think he said something like, you know, I never want to taste failure again. He's just determined to carry on voting this thing down. So I struggle to see how the deal in its current form passes.
I think there's also the fact that what would actually happen in a second referendum? And I don't think that you have people actively on the Leave side saying this is the best thing that could happen, a second referendum. But there is definitely a view amongst Brexiteers that this is no slam dunk for Remain, if even if you got there. That while Parliament might be quite against Brexit, if you look at the numbers, or at least be pushing towards a softer Brexit, there hasn't been that mass change in public opinion that a lot of people had predicted would be happening at this point. So I think that even were Tusk to get part of his dream and get to holding the second referendum, it might then become a nightmare, when actually there's nothing to say you wouldn't have Leave win by a higher margin.
We also saw another international actor get involved in the Brexit debate today when the US House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that a trade deal was unlikely to be ratified with the United States, especially if it compromised the Good Friday Agreement. James, do you think she has a point?
Well, look, the Irish-American lobby has a significant clout on Capitol Hill, and I think it would be very difficult to get anything through Congress if it clearly violated the Good Friday Agreement. Now, the caveat I would put to that is, I think it's not quite, I don't think this is quite as black and white a question as some people say. I also think that there are bigger obstacles to a US-UK trade deal than this. You know, for example, agriculture. You know, one of the US's, the US always asks in trade negotiations for its agricultural produce to be accepted. That would be a hard sell in the UK Parliament, because you know you would then get into all of the chlorinated chicken, hormone, beef, you name all the other scare stories. You know, you get, you know, I mean, and obviously it would be a hard sell also for MPs for agricultural constituencies, because US agriculture is particularly productive and low cost. Now, I personally think that's an insurmountable obstacle in a Parliament which had a comfortable governing majority, but we haven't had one of those since the 2005 Parliament, and that is quite a long time ago now. And I think that is so. I think the US-UK trade deal has a lot of difficulties, even without this question.
Katie, do you think that means we'll see Conservatives rooting for a Donald Trump victory in 2020?
Well, I think there are certain Conservatives who, I don't know if admiration is the right word, have time for Donald Trump, but there are plenty who don't. But I think actually her comments were pointing to the fact that even if you have Donald Trump as president, he isn't the only voice here. You still have to get it through other politicians in the US. You still have to go through other processes. And therefore, I think it's just showing that even though Donald Trump has said it'd be very simple, UK is front of the queue, if you have a cleaner Brexit, probably outside of the current withdrawal agreement, there would be complications. I think Nancy Pelosi's comments on weakening the Good Friday Agreement relate obviously to what would happen in a no-deal Brexit. If to the border, would there be a hard border? But the strong view on actually some in Cabinet and lots of the Conservative Party is no one wants a hard border. And actually, were you to test the theory, because it's so difficult for the Republic of Ireland, that you would find a way around that issue. So I think there'll be some who actually don't, who think push comes to shove, this wouldn't actually be such a problem.
James, where do you think this leaves Liam Fox's project as International Trade Secretary?
I think Liam Fox at the moment is kind of fighting a rearguard action to see off a full-blown customs union, to maintain some semblance of an independent trade policy. But his job is undoubtedly more difficult than he envisaged it would be when he first got it, because, you know, the argument was that the UK was going to do trade deals in the classic way, an economy of a type of the UK would, which is you essentially offered to open up your agricultural market and manufacturing markets in exchange for getting your service industries access to other countries. That's the kind of classic dynamic that would play out in an economy like the UK. But if you look at the deal the UK is going to strike with the EU, or you know, any deal the UK strikes with the EU, is going to make it much more difficult to do that, because it probably is going to maintain conformity with EU agricultural standards to kind of simplify food exports back and forth. And on manufacturing, you know, the UK keeps saying that it doesn't intend to deviate from European standards immediately. You know, it might do over time, but it won't do straight away. And I think it is quite telling that, you know, even joining the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, TPP, which Liam Fox is very keen on doing, would require the other countries in TPP to be prepared to waive some of the rules to let the UK in, because of what the UK, if it went down the route right, Theresa May wants to go down, the things that the UK would end up having agreed, committed to doing with the EU.
And Finally, we also saw Labour's Shadow Justice Secretary, Richard Bergen, being in the news today. Katie, can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so Richard Bergen is in the news relating to a story, actually, which dates back when the Daily Mail reported that he had basically made a comment in which he'd said Zionism is the enemy of peace. And he was later asked about his alleged comments on the BBC's Daily Politics show by Andrew Neil in March 2018. And he denied saying it, saying he had never said that and it was not his view. Now, a video has emerged, dug out by a journalist, of Bergen actually making those comments at a Labour meeting when he told the audience that the enemy of the Palestinian people are Zionists and Zionism is the enemy of peace and the enemy of the Palestinian people. Now, it seems a pretty black and white issue. It's very hard for him to go back from this. So there are some who obviously would think, surely, as a shadow minister, he is now going to face the sack. I think that anyone who has been following the saga of Labour and claims of anti-Semitism over the past couple of years will probably expect that that might not happen, particularly straight away or actually at all. This is someone who is a close Corbyn ally, has been rewarded for his loyalty by a job, even though he's a fairly young MP. And were Corbyn to sack him, it would be a surprise.
No, it's not. I also think it is. This is a kind of, whatever credibility he had, Richard Bergen had, is now completely and utterly destroyed, because they're kind of in the rules of political discourse, right? You cannot say to an interviewer repeatedly, "I didn't say that." You can flat out deny something that turns out to be completely true. He didn't in that interview attempt to contextualise his remarks. He didn't attempt to say what he meant by Zionism was X, Y, or Z. He just said, "No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I didn't say that." And he was offered kind of multiple opportunities to say, "Oh, I did," or to try and defend his remarks. He didn't take that. He just denied it. And once you do that, you know, what is the point in having a politician in for an interview if they are just going to do what Richard Bergen did? And I think that that means that, you know, his credibility, whatever there was of it, is now gone.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening. Now, in case you missed it, The Spectator currently has an offer, 12 issues for £12 plus a £20 John Lewis voucher. To access the offer, all you have to do is go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.